Hi, this is Joel Blackstock with the Taproot Therapy Collective podcast, and today we have an article about architecture that I'm going to read that is called Frank Lloyd Wrong, Why We Didn't Take the Right Lessons from Frank Lloyd Wright's Legacy. If you want to look at the article on our blog, in addition to listening to it on the podcast, there are some photographs that go along with it, which make it a little bit easier to see. And so I will begin that article now. So I mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright quite a bit on the blog. We talk about design and the psychology of design and architecture and psychology in different parts of life. A lot of people have asked why. You know, what is it that they see him, I guess, as kind of dated to lump him in with all of the, kind of modernist architects that have flat roofs. So what is it that I see in Wright's work? Why do I think that he is interesting? And the answer is, I think his process is a little bit more interesting than all of his designs, because I think, design is always a work in progress, or design is always an imperfect process. It's more about finding the way that you do it, not just making the perfect design. You know, there's hard answers and there's soft answers in psychology. And so hard answers are objective things like, penicillin cures this infection, or this randomized controlled trial shows that this thing works best on this kind of patient for this diagnosis. Soft answers are going to be more subjective and they're going to be less testable. So when Bessel van der Kolk says something like, neuroscience research shows that the only way that we can change the way we feel is by becoming aware of our inner experience and learning to befriend what is going on inside ourselves, it makes sense that he's saying that we have to acknowledge all the parts of us, we have to experience those parts, we have to deconstruct ourselves into a series of parts, and we have to realize that we are all of those parts, not just the ones that we like, and kind of re-identify. Like, we can intuitively understand that, but we can't do a test to say, is this right or wrong? There's not a way to do a randomized controlled trial about that, yet we know what it means. It's a soft answer. And so, with soft sciences, you're always in the process of trying to get it right, but it's never quite done, And art is never done, goes the quote. It just stops in nice places. I think Da Vinci said that. And so it might have been Michelangelo. Please don't email me. But design is something that will always be a soft science. We'll never build the perfect house or create the definitive couch that never needs any further iteration. Design is always kind of trying to meld process, style, meet the limitations of any point in economics and society and manufacturing. And in doing that, it's never done. You don't just say, okay, we did the perfect one, now let's try and design something else. It's always changing. And so it's probably easier to say what Frank Lloyd Wright was not than what he was. He was not a very good guy. Despite his talent as an architect, Wright was erratic and just indefensible as a person. He was a narcissist. He was a serial adulterer. He was a liar. He's been called a compulsive liar before. I'm going to say no, he was just a liar, because when you are a compulsive liar, you lie about things that do not benefit you. And most of Wright's lies were to get what he wanted. He would lie about the value of art, or he would lie about, when the Frank Lloyd Wright's building in Japan was not demolished during the earthquake that happened. He went to everybody and was like, my building was the only one that didn't fall down. Well, most of the buildings didn't fall down. But most of the things were in service of narcissism. I don't think he was a compulsive liar, but he definitely did not have a problem lying. He was a mean spirit and just kind of inveterate overspender. He exploited his workers. He's just not a good guy. So that's not why I look up to him. Or not look up to him, but why, that's not why I admire his process. I don't look up to him. So many times a person's biography shows, clues as to why they have this kind of disordered personality and what they're compensating for. Wright's biography doesn't really give you a reason for him to be the way that he was. I think he was just brilliant and he was prophetically influential. A ton was wrong with the kind of artistic and industrial assumptions of the time. And he knew he was right. He had a massive superiority complex. He knew that he was seeing the future and he didn't mind humiliating people and telling them that. And so he never really integrated any of his gifts as an artist into a coherent or healthy psyche. He did experience tragedy as an adult. His wife and his children, her child, he married one of his clients' wives at one point, and she left her husband, and she was murdered along with her children and some of his staff at Taliesin, his home. But that's pretty late in life. He was kind of a bad guy before that, so I'm sure that didn't make, that was definitely traumatic for him. But I don't know that that explains anything. Like some people try and do. And Wright also just isn't always a perfect architect. Like I don't love everything he did. He tries a lot, which I think is better than just kind of doing the same thing forever. And he definitely is like always wrestling with new ideas and how to move on to the next thing. But some of his revival periods are just really cold, and they move away from his original ideas of form before, you know, he puts form before function in some designs, I think, in service of experimentation that doesn't really pay off, even though that goes against his own principles. And so what makes him a mandatory design reference point to me? Why you have to talk about him, even if you don't like him, when you're talking about design and style, not just in architecture, is it's kind of a soft answer. He was able to pull a ton of things together and articulate what architecture was in a way that I don't think had been done before. If it was done before, it was done by, you know, somebody like Hannah Arendt or philosophers, not architects. They were talking about the nature of art, but he did it as a professional, not as a philosopher. You know, I had a college professor who told me one time that reading works in translation is like making love through a plate glass window. He was talking about reading Latin and Greek, and that you really, unless you speak Latin and ancient Greek, you don't really get the feel for what the Odyssey, how beautiful the writing is. And architecture is kind of the same way. There's some photos on the blog. There's some visual tours of his stuff. But really, if you just go into his spaces, you feel something. That is what I'm describing. You feel something that he says over and over what the point of architecture is and what he wants you to feel. And one, I'll talk a little bit about what that is. But a big part of what it is I think he makes the structure a node between our humanity, the way we use a space, you know, practically what we need, the natural world around it, which is why none of his buildings in different places are the same. He matches the natural world and the site. He would contemplate the site a whole lot. And then thirdly, a sort of elevated spiritual idea of the purpose of the building. So there's a practical purpose, more of like a subjective, spiritual, higher purpose. And then there's the natural world. And so these things intersecting was what he tried to feel. And I think that's really neat. He called his architecture organic architecture. And so he believed that the building should emerge naturally from their surrounding and blend seamlessly with the environment around it. You look at a poem like Wallace Stevens, The Anecdote of the Jar, that when you put something in a place, that thing changes the place you put it in, and the place you put it in changes the thing because they're in conversation with each other. And Wright was really into that. He sought to enhance the beauty of the site and to participate in the beauty. He was viewing it like he already had a painting. Nature was the painting, and he had to make a change to it. So he's going to be respectful. He wasn't just going to come to a picture of a landscape and then all of a sudden, you know, paint, spray paint graffiti on it. He was going to try and make the thing he was adding to it part of it in a way that a lot of architects didn't do at the time. Or they saw the point of architecture as beating back or taming, overcoming nature, not really conversing with it. And so his designs, they often feature like horizontal lines at angles that mimicked horizons. He would kind of echo the ripples, curves, peaks, you know, whatever the surrounding geography was in the structure. And then he would use local materials that looked like they came from the site or did come from the site, like wood and stone, and try and keep paint the same colors as what things would be at different times of year. I mean, he would look at these buildings, sometimes the sites for the buildings, you know, for a year, 2 years before he built something, because, you know, he wanted it to work in the winter too. He wanted it, you know, it was talking to seasons. You know, just incredibly complex ability to listen to detail in a way that I think is very mindful and interesting in his, you know, professional life, something he never was able to do personally. He was not a mindful person. He was always in debt. He was always having affairs. He was always having fights. But he was able to do this professionally. And so, you know, for Wright, form followed function, meaning that you built the thing to be useful. And then you, once you had the usefulness, you made it pretty. You didn't just do what we think design is now, I think, too much, where we just make something cool looking and then say, okay, well, that's neat and that great because it looks good. But it doesn't work as a house. It doesn't work as a phone. It doesn't work as a toaster. It's designed to be stylish, not to do its job. And Wright believed that function was the point of architecture. You were figuring out how people lived. You were observing them. Not just nature, he would observe these families. I mean, sometimes he'd go to their house and he would take tapes and he would watch them. And You would see how they cooked dinner and where they ate and where they walked to build something that made enhance their routine practically. And then also was a part of nature. And then thirdly, enhanced their routine spiritually, which is my next point. So not just does he matching the way that the form followed the function of what the space was for materially and practically, he also kind of would echo greater cultures, religious themes. He would take these patterns that I think are really neat, and he would infuse the structures with these repetitive motifs that created this sense of continuity and coherence, because they happened on a big scale, a medium scale, and a teeny tiny small scale. Sometimes the carvings are so intricate, and even if you don't notice it intellectually, you're feeling that pattern kind of ripple from the outside when you're walking up to the building, to the inside when you're looking at the structure of the windows, to the teeny tiny cuts on the grates. They all sort of flow together. They're a pattern that is starting very big and then becoming very small. And a lot of them had a lot of symbolism and meaning. Sometimes he documented that in the plans and would tell you that this represented, this Indian tribe's belief or this land or this thing. And then other times we don't really know there was meaning there, but it wasn't his. It wasn't something that he said what it was. And so one of the things that's really interesting to me about Wright spaces is he didn't really design them. Like, he was an architect. We think about the person who takes out a blank sheet of paper and starts drawing this big, pretty thing. Or if you know any architects, maybe they take out a cocktail napkin and draw on it. They're sort of always doing this, but Wright didn't do that. I mean, instead he went and he listened to the space, he listened to the people, and then he listened to the kind of spiritual or metaphysical or higher purpose. The third point doesn't quite fit neatly into one word. It was a conversation with a practical purpose of people, what they needed the building for, what the natural world was imposing on the space, and then thirdly, this sort of higher ideal. And what that higher ideal is, Wright never articulates perfectly, but he is adamant that that's something, that third thing is something that you need to be aspiring to fuse, not just with the natural world, not just with the structure, what is needed for people, but also with a higher ideal. And so, what you want to call that, I don't know, but I think that's an interesting concept. So, good design to me is always somebody who's actually willing to sit with all of these limitations that make design harder and then try and wrestle them together. It's pulling these things that are conflicting forces and limitations into each other in a way that is ingenious. And, if you're following a fad or a trend, everything looks the same, or gunmetal's in this year, so I'm going to throw out my wardrobe and just do this. You're not really thinking, you're just kind of following what you're told, and that stuff will look dated very quickly. One of the reasons why Wright's buildings don't look dated, most of them, I think is because his design is kind of timeless. His process resulted in this timeless message you can still hear. And that started with him listening to something. He didn't just sit down with a blank page and say, I'm going to draw a building. It was really trying to hear the building as it was supposed to exist. Even though Wright was a raging narcissist that took a credit for a lot of things, some of them not true, he didn't really take credit for that design process. He saw it as this form of intuition that anyone could tap into and that more architects should tap into. And he thought, I'm better than everybody just because I do this. Y'all could do it too if you want to, but you're too proud and you're too broken by academia and you're too in your own head about intellect and style that you can't just hear what's supposed to be built. I think that's interesting. He did, however, take a lot of credit for other people's work because he would sort of do these loose sketches, and his process was pretty intuitive. His draftsmen and his construction workers, a lot of the time the tradesmen, they would just sort of fill in the patterns. Like, he expected them to do that. We don't know exactly how much, especially his larger projects, of the tiny minute details he did by hand, because he taught them how to make these patterns. And then they did them. He didn't pay his people very well, and he didn't credit them. He took credit for the building, even though they were doing a lot of it. So he didn't take credit for the process. He thought that anyone could just hear this intuition and do it, but he did take credit for other people doing his process, if that makes sense. So one of the ways that his process is articulated that I think is just gorgeous, Taliesin was one of the houses that he built. There's a fire and a murder, and then he goes into a period of mourning, and then later in life he goes back to it, he redoes the house, designs it again, and then now it's like an architectural school. I don't know if they still do it on site. I think they ran out of money. I'm not really sure what the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation's doing, but for a while during his life and after his death, Taliesin was an architecture school. And so one of the, this is something he wrote himself, but this is one of the lessons from that, that was teaching the people how to do architecture, do design. So this is Frank Lloyd Wright writing to the students. Prepare a geometric study of any Wisconsin wildflower, endeavoring to get the essence of its inherent character. Organize this pattern into a design structured upon a unit system, and strive to establish a grammar which will be inseparable consequence of the design and element and unit system. Grammatical pattern must be consistently of the same source, of the same direction of from that source, and on a separate overlay isolate a geometric unit system in linear pattern only. Know the common name of the wildflower, and then bring a few of those flowers to class. Every design worth considering as a work of art must have a grammar of its own. And grammar, in this sense, means the same thing in any construction, whether it be of words, or of stone, or of wood. It is the shape relationship between the various elements that enter into the constitution of the thing. Your work must be consistently grammatical for it to be understood as a work of art. So I'm going to stop for a second here. He's saying that you have to be able to have a consistent system with which you listen to all parts of something if it's really going to be art. If you're not doing that, you're just repeating a style or a fad. If the tradition's 100 years old, or if it's just what's in vogue that summer, it's not design because you're just copying something. You're not hearing something. So back to Wright's sheet. Grammar may be deduced from some plant that has appealed to me as a certain property in line or form of the sumac I used in the Dana House in Springfield, and the motif is adhered throughout the building. All my planning was devised on a properly proportional unit system. I found that this would keep all to scale, ensuring consistent proportion through the design, which became like a tapestry, a consistent fabric woven of interdependent, related units, however various, they invariably, it appears in organic architecture as a visible feature in the fabric of the design. Ensuring unity of proportion, the harmony of texture is thus with the scale of all parts within the complete ensemble. Let us learn to see within at least far enough to grasp essential patterns in all created things. Method in creation will come freely to him who learns to see in the abstract. Study the geometry that is the idea of every form. A quail, a snail, a shell, a fish. Take for analysis the more simple, obvious things first, and then take the texture of the trees. Learn the essential patterns that make the oak and distinguish it from the essential pattern that makes the pine. And then make new ones. Try after this the curling vine, flowing water, or the curving sand. And then try the flowers, the butterflies, and bees. And a chrysanthemum is easy. A rock or a rose is difficult. And I do not mean to take the obvious surface effects that differentiate each, but to go within and find the essential geometry of pattern that gives character to each. And that is the proper study for an architect who would find method and get legitimate effects. Try this method and gradually discipline your power to see. Get patiently to the point where you naturally see this element of pattern in everything. Frank Lloyd Wright. So the heart of what he's saying there is he's like, don't just draw the thing as a pattern, because it isn't. Listen to the thing, even if it's a rock, even if it's a rose, and try and look up the tiny pieces of what make that thing itself. So don't take it and make a pattern out of the shape of the rose. Listen to the pattern that is making up the rose. And then draw that. You know, take everything as a part of a small part, see the pattern that makes it up, and then the larger pattern that it is a part of. And that's very much how he saw the structure. It was this thing that was in between the natural world and the world of the human. And also, you know, this sense of time, timelessness, that you were listening to something older to predict what was going to happen in the future. That if you were just chasing the fad that was around you, it was going to be outdated. But if you looked at the way that the natural world and people had always kind of eternally moved and functioned, and you brought that into style, that style would be timeless. And I think you can see examples on the, if you look at the blog article, of people doing this. I have a picture of the real plant, and then I have a picture of people who did this assignment. that went through his school, what they drew. And it's neat to see how that works. It's hard to explain what he's saying there, but I think it's incredibly profound. You know, like I can hear a lot of things in Frank Lloyd Wright's thought process. There's definitely a lot of Plato and a little bit of Aristotle. Like he's kind of into forms and into this theory of like an absolute truth. And you kind of hear that in his writing. He never mentions Jung. He mentions Japan all the time. He really likes this one scholar who does a lot of work with Japan. And then he gets really into Japanese art and culture. But as far as I know, I think Wright stayed as far away as psychology as he could. He, you know, probably encountered Freud just because that was more in the water, but I don't think he ever came across anything like Jung or archetypes. I've never seen him mention anything, not just say that he read it. It's not just that I never found any place where somebody said he read Jung or he said something about Jung. More that when you read his writing about places where Jungian ideas would come up, you don't see any of that in his thinking. So I don't think he ever encountered it. A lot of times, and I haven't read everything that Wright wrote, but a lot of times I think when someone is talking about something, you can tell not their influences, but you can tell based on their vocabulary and the way they organize ideas, what kind of thinkers they've encountered and how that's affected their thinking, even if they're not aware of it. I don't see that in Wright. So I don't think that he knew who Jung was. You can also look, if you Google or look up Saguaro forms, that's my favorite piece of stained glass. It's a pattern that Wright made. It's also in one of our therapist, Christy Wood's office on a blanket. Her office is very Frank Lloyd Wright inspired. There's some architecture stuff on the walls. And then there's some, you know, arts and crafts furniture. So Wright was an outsider artist, and he believed that true architectural genius came from subjective experience, you feeling something and your intuition and this innate understanding of environment and communication. It didn't come from education. It didn't come from academics. That put him at huge odds with a lot of other architects who wanted to stand on all of the, well, I have a PhD from the Beaux-Arts University or whatever, or Beaux-Arts. Some people say Beaux-Arts. I don't know what's right. I know I don't really like the style very much at all. But a ton of these people at the time were trying to replicate these old patterns, and they had, you know, you had to go all the way through, you know, French New Empire and Queen Anne's style and know all these styles going back to the ancient Greeks. And it was all about the style, sort of. It wasn't really about the structure, but it was about the kind of, you know, I don't want to say style again, but the way that these buildings were decorated was what they thought was important, not what the buildings really were. They were just sort of repeating older forms, and Wright didn't like that. So he drops out of university. He can't complete it. I don't think at that time you even needed an architecture license. Like, I think if somebody paid you to build a building, you could just do it. I don't know how that worked, but I know he didn't even have a degree. And if he had stayed in college, he probably would never have gone on to do the architect that he did. He wanted to get people who had not yet been corrupted by academia and then teach them his process of listening and turning on intuition. And he felt strongly that when your ego was very entrenched in intellect and thinking and you were puffed up with all of that, you just couldn't get it out of your head. It kind of broke people and they weren't able to hear this thing that was just innate and precious and available to everybody who had ears to hear it. So, you know, his disdain for academia puts him at odds with a lot of people. He gets in a lot of fights. He saw those institutions as being very prohibitive for the profession moving in a good direction. And he created buildings that were like not only functional, but they were supposed to contribute to the overall well-being and happiness of the occupant. And he saw those old styles and traditional forms as ways of listening to the Roman Empire and the needs of somebody from the Bronze Age, but not from the person now. And so he saw the traditional floor plan and the ornamentation of popular styles as hindrances to good design that would be meeting somebody where they were and giving them what they wanted to see, what they wanted to live in, and in the way that they lived. And so a lot of, you know, I talked about this in a couple articles, but there's two schools of architecture. There's the modernists and the classicists, and that's kind of the biggest schools where the most fights happen. And the classicists are repeating historic styles, And then the modernists are trying to throw old styles out and build, they modernists like new materials. And so they're saying, well let's try and you could never, they only built the Parthenon because they didn't have this cool plastic stuff. We could build this crazy shape that they couldn't with stone. And then the traditional architects, the classicists are like, no, the Parthenon's perfect. Your big wibbly crazy shaped building is ugly. And these schools fight a lot. I don't really see Frank Lloyd Wright as being a part of either of them. He always gets lumped in with the modernists because his buildings are not, you know, terribly traditional. And there's not, you know, there's things like flat roofs that you see in modernist architecture. But a lot of the other modernists like Le Corbusier and all these people, like their buildings did not work. Like even in their lifetime, the flat roofs were leaking and they didn't use material very well. They just sort of did crazy stuff just to do it. And Wright's buildings are still there and they still work well. And, you know, there aren't those sort of like huge systemic problems in the way that they design. And so somebody like Wright, I don't know if he is a modernist, you know, classicists typically hate him. And then modernists don't really see him as anything special, but accept him into the movement. I don't see him as a modernist because when you look at somebody like Frank Gehry, who is another architect who his stuff, he draws these crazy wibbly lines and just goes wild making these weird things. But when he does that, there's no thought to how someone's actually going to use this space. Like when I went to one of his buildings, it's a museum and there's like, it's this huge wibbly sheet metal stuff, and it's kind of impressive when you're walking up to it because you've never seen anything like this. And then you go inside, and it's like, okay, so those wild walls meant that half of this is unusable. You know, like, why didn't you put the air conditioner somewhere where I couldn't see it, you know, up in the top and hide it? Or why didn't you? So why is half this room at some weird angle where it's using up all your sight and all your room, but no one can even walk there because the ceiling is too low because you wanted this crazy shape on the outside? Oh, and then also you didn't read the building code, evidently, for the American Disabilities Act. So now your space, you didn't think about the fact that you were going to have handrails for people who are older, and you're going to have like bumper rails because the wall came down at this angle for somebody who is visually impaired because they would walk into the wall and get hurt since your walls are angled. So now there's this clunky rail that they would have to use for their cane to tap on. And that's making people trip and over. Like, there's no thought in a lot of modernists. They really just get on AutoCAD or Revit and they draw something nuts and then they just put rooms in it. And there's nothing about how things fit together, how people use space, what the flow is, the sort of archetypal ideas of when somebody walks into a building, their brain is just going to kind of naturally take them to the right. Like, you know, that people have these, I'm not going to go terribly into that, but people have like a lot of biases in the way that they use space that are genetic. I mean, they're just inborn. They've done all these studies. There's no reason for it. It's cross-cultural. It's just, if you build a store one way, people won't know how to use it. And a lot of the modernists like Gehry, they don't use any of that stuff. And so the buildings, you know, one, they don't really hold up. They just are so expensive to work on. And, you know, his crazy shape isn't to be like, Frank Gehry's crazy shape isn't to be like, okay, so the water is going to fall off here, so I better put another angle here so that I pull water away from the building, because if I pull water away from the building, then it's going to last longer because it's not going to rust or it's not going to leak. And so this is visually neat, but the purpose is to manage. No, he just makes a giant sheet metal cube and water pools up and somebody makes it out of steel. But there's not any thought other than self-indulgence. And like one of the things that Frank Gehry's house, if you ever see it, he has like this giant cube and then glass wall in the back of the house. And somebody like Wright, who's listening to a site for like a year, sometimes before he would even draw anything, because he wanted to see how all the seasons affected it and the storms and the wind and how the family lived. And they're putting a ton of thought into really hearing what is needed from the people and hearing what is needed or reflective of the nature. The reason that Frank Gehry did that addition to his house is that he was just shaving. And then he like looked up at the corner of his bathroom and he was like, I wish natural light came through there. What if it came through there? So he got a hammer, basically, and just started beating his wall and ripped a thing out. And then was like, well, that looks kind of cool. I like that. You know, that's neat. And then he left the structural boards there, but ripped all the plaster wall out and then put like a sheet of, had people come in and put a sheet of glass there. And then was like, okay, out here, what should I do? Well, I'll just put like a giant cube and it can also be the greenhouse. It'll be made of glass. So like one of the walls coming off of his back bathroom, even though his house is more of a traditional architecture thing that he added onto, is like this crazy glass wall. But that's how he got there. He just literally was shaving and was like, oh, I kind of want to see light. I'm going to knock a hole in the wall. I mean, very impulsive and self-indulgent and not a thoughtful guy. You know, he can talk about it later, but that's how he did it. And somebody like a director like Zack Snyder, I'm going way to the woods here and away from the article. The article on the blog might give you a better overlay of information. But a director like Zack Snyder, who I don't really like at all, who nothing feels intentional in the movies. It just feels like he's sitting there being like, well, that would be cool. This would be cool, too. Well, this should happen next. And nothing happens. There's no character development. It doesn't do anything original. It doesn't build to anything. It's just somebody grabbing random crap. And that is not, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. It's an enormous amount of architects, but that's what I see in a lot of modernism that I don't see in Wright. And that's why I have a hard time just putting Wright in that movement, is I don't know that that's what he is. But again, he does blow up all these classical principles. You know, if he doesn't break them, he could never have done like the cantilevered structure that made falling water so famous. You know, that does not come from classical design. It's a totally modern process. He would never have been able to use all the asymmetry he used. I mean, that's another reason that his buildings look so modern is that they're not symmetrical. He didn't have a problem about making everything mirror the way that Renaissance and Roman architecture does. He based a lot of things, though, like a classical architect would, on these mathematical formulas, like the golden mean and the golden ratio, and these concepts of mathematical proportion that come from nature that are used in Renaissance mathematics and architecture, and to a certain extent in Greek and Roman architecture. But what's kind of funny to me is like they always make fun of Wright, the classicist, for not being symmetrical, that his buildings will not have this symmetry. But then you look at like the golden mean or the golden ratio, and like it isn't symmetrical. It sort of opens like a shell. So sometimes he's actually modeling the patterns that Renaissance architecture was built on more accurately, maybe, than classical traditions, which is kind of this weird thing. Like, the classicists want to go back to Greek and Roman architecture. And I think Wright wanted to go further back than that. He wanted to go all the way back to the early spiritual heart of mankind and the early spiritual patterns and bits of nature. He wasn't trying to go back to, they wanted to keep everything in this one point. And Wright was not really reaching for the future. He was also reaching for the past, but I think he was reaching further back than a lot of classical architects that only wanted to stop with, you know, the Western architecture, starting with Greece and Rome. And Wright was trying to hear something that was more profound and probably more ancient. He wanted to make architecture about the people of today, not traditions of the past, but he didn't want it to just be about a myopic sense of the people of today. He wanted it to be about the future, too. And if you're trying to define that higher power thing that I keep talking about in Wright's work, that is it, I think, is that it wasn't just for the family that he was building it for. It was for the family when they were 20 years older than the clients that he had right now, when they were dead and their families were living in the building, their extended families, when there were people who were encountering these structures in the future. It wasn't just about doing the thing that people wanted right now. It was about giving them this gift that they would want in the future. And I don't see a ton of that in modern architecture. It tends to age pretty quickly. So the takeaway that I think is the point of Wright is really a deep and profound intuition or ability to listen. And, you know, intuition is at its root the ability to see very complex patterns within something. And so the best musicians do that sonically, while the best therapists do that through analysis of somebody's emotions and their family structure and their identity and their speech patterns. You're looking for patterns as an intuitive. Wright's architecture was a semi-unconscious tuning into the patterns of the natural world and of human life and about our artistic and our spiritual aspirations. And so when you visit Wright's spaces, you can still hear him listening to patterns that we've kind of forgotten how to hear. You know, Wright's houses often wrap around the family like a shell, you know, or arms like in this kind of hug the family areas of the house. And unlike Victorian buildings that needed to communicate power and class towards the street, big yard, social standing, the origin of the yard is that I make enough money that I don't have to use my land to grow food. I'm just going to grow grass. And, a lot of the detail and ornamentation you put onto things like columns and the outside of the house, it was about saying who you were, right? Sees that is not relevant anymore. His buildings shelter the family from the street, and then they open towards the backyard like a shell. In Wright's homes, the focus of the house is on the hearth and the family room and a central garden or a pool a lot of the time. The street-facing walls are stripped of detail, and his houses often have this minimalist rock or brick exteriors facing the street. He did a lot of houses, so this is generally true of all of them, but they do vary where he built them geographically. Prairie homes look very different than Incan Revival, but they do have not the same floor plan, but the same pattern the floor plan is built on. And they often include kind of water or rock moats, and usually small slit windows with a little bridge that goes to the house. And there, I see them as kind of a reimagining of the European castle as the center of civilization, but in an American setting and on a smaller scale. So he's saying, these buildings, society used to center around a king or a social hierarchy, but now American society centers around the middle class and the family. And that message, I think, is important in the way that he built homes. His homes are some of his most interesting buildings. So if there's anything in Wright's biography that occurred early enough in his life to provide some kind of psychological explanation for just the madness of his personal life, it probably would be the contentious divorce of his parents that some people felt like had caused him distress. And that he, and it's possible that that early loss of this spiritual, emotional, and familial center in his life informed his career trajectory by, making him want to recenter the profession of architecture around the idea of a nurturing maternal community built space and also a greater spiritual or emotional center. He felt like architecture had lost its center, and it's possible that because he, a lot of times our artists, this projection of youth, was doing that because of something that happened to him as a kid. And so, I think good design is a kind of simulacrum. It's a simulacrum is a copy without an original, or something that's been copied so many times that its origins are not as visible as the changes through the copying. And it is, good design is a copy of something that is unconscious and deep within us, that does not come from nature, but it comes from a reflection of nature within ourselves. And our inability to deal with the outer realities of nature or the inner realities of the way that we internalize it, they become what we project into art. So our artistic center comes from an early childhood pain. And the shadow projection becomes, where we are excellent professionally, but we fail interpersonally. And it becomes where we excel with unconscious intuition, but a lot of times that unconscious intuition is never actualized in a way where we can bring it consciously into our personal lives. And so we repeat and we create our trauma until we face it. And I wish that we could say that most artists face their trauma, but unfortunately, most people choose not to go into these scary places. I've said a lot, there's a lot of reasons why people come to therapy, but underneath all of them, there's really only one choice that we're making. It's, do I go into the scary thing that I feel like if I go back there, I'll die? And do I face that? And if I face it, do I grow? Or do I just kind of choose to avoid and ignore and run from that my whole life, or blame other people for it or whatever? And I think Wright, definitely fails to grow as a person, but he does grow a lot as an architect. But sadly, a lot of his intuition remains unconscious. And that's true of a lot of artists. I wish that I could say it wasn't true of a lot of therapists, but it is. I have to fight that tendency in myself. All therapists should be in therapy. And where I think therapy becomes damaging is where somebody says, well, I've done all my work, this is how I got better, so that's how you have to get better. And that's where therapy can become a problem. Because you haven't dealt with something and you're trying to give other people the medicine that you need. And you see that obsession where therapists like really want the patient won't do this. And it's like, well, okay, well, maybe they want to, there's an energy. And you see that. And I think that's definitely who Wright was, but You know, timeless art and architecture is inseparable from psychology because it requires us to set our individual ego aside and make contact with something that is deep inside our collective humanity. And so we don't design this stuff at random. I mean, maybe Frank Gehry did. I don't think Wright does. My criticism with Gehry is that it's not that the stuff doesn't look cool. It's that, like, if you had come to him on a different day, you would have gotten a completely different building. He sits down without any thought, and then he draws something that's kind of crazy. And there isn't, it's not in service of anything greater. There's not a process other than this is kind of a crazy thing that I can build. And you look at Art Wright and you think if you got the little Men in Black, you know, memory eraser thing, and you brought him back to the same site with the same family, he would have come up with a building that was almost the same. You know, if you deleted this from his memory and then had him design it again, because his process was so depth oriented that it would have pulled up a lot of the same elements. And so, you know, we don't do these things in a vacuum. They come from our psychology, which is why I'm putting it on a podcast and a blog about psychology, something about architecture. And I don't think all of Wright's work is perfect, but I think his conception of the role that architecture plays in our lives is profound. You know, by infusing his structures with meaningful patterns and symbols taken from nature and human culture, Wright transcended the boundaries of mere functionality. You know, he created spaces that stirred emotion and connected deeply with the human spirit. He saw architecture as an intersection of the human, the natural, and the metaphysical, and his buildings were designed more like altars to hold the interplay of these forces he saw as sacred. And architecture does shape our lives, and it does enrich our experiences. Whether we notice it or not, architecture is affecting you, and it is helping you or harming you at any moment. When you are in a building for most of your life, and that building has an effect on you, whether or not you know what it's doing and where that effect comes from. And the contemporary buildings that we inhabit today, you know, they still talk to us, but what they say is now problematic. You know, they tell us that we're disposable cogs in a set of business transactions, and that the most temporary and disposable structures that can be built are all we deserve. You know, we send our children into these windowless cinder block buildings with linoleum and concrete floors and drains on the ground so they can be hosed down, and they're encircled by chain link. And most American schools are built like prisons, and we send kids there to learn. But what are we sending them in there to learn, you know, in this cinder block hell? You know, Leon Krier was an architect that we talked to a while back on the podcast, and one of the things he told me I got a kick out of was that he had met the Jungian analyst James Hollis at one point. He's Jungian. James Hollis is dead now, but he had met him years ago, and he told him that you know, European offices are designed so that the eye moves upwards in this aspirational way to look at heaven and the point of the building, like lines draw you up, almost like a church. And American offices are designed with this harsh fluorescent lighting and these cheap drop ceilings, that styrofoam-like tile they put up there. So that you would looked away from it and you had to peer down into hell. And I always thought that was funny because I really do not like drop ceilings. I don't know why we ever agreed to do that. And so much of the stuff, like, I just don't get, you know. It's like, I was so frustrated when I saw where my daughter was going to school and we're in this school system that's supposed to be good. And it's like, there's not windows. It's just cinder blocks. Like, and everyone's like, well, that's just how everything was built in the 60s and 70s. And it's like, look, there was any point in history where this was the way that we built things, one, we need to apologize about that forever and look at it, and we don't need to rest until all of this stuff is corrected. Because I don't want a child to go into this place. It looks like they committed a crime. You know, my elementary school, I went to Shades Cahaba and Homewood, it had these big windows, it had these sconces, it had all of this light. I mean, what I remember when I think of school, elementary school, was like looking out at trees and like looking out at nature and seeing like the orchard and watching the weather while the person was talking and feeling like I was in a community and I was like in a place where I was supposed to learn something good. You know, my high school was built like a cinder block hellscape, and my middle school, and I just remember the stark contrast of going in there and being like, I don't want to be here. This place feels like an attack on me. It feels like I did something wrong. It feels like this is not a good place. And I don't think everyone is as conscious of that as I was, but I still think that affects everyone. And design is something that has a pretty big hold on our psychology, that we are hearing whether or not we are listening to it. And, you know, so when Wright designed, he listened to the harmony of the intersecting patterns of nature and human life. And he represented these visually across the spaces that he designed. He took broader natural patterns of the landscape and he had them ripple across the structure in, you know, macro, meso, and micro scales. When he broke the rules of classical architecture, it was only in service to support the practical function or to communicate the broader significance of place and setting and purpose. You know, we live in a natural world, but we must make it partially a human one. And we also serve a higher purpose. And we should think mindfully about what we want that purpose to be. Where we live changes how we live and how we live together. An architecture used to make our lives art, and now it's an afterthought in this process of turning our lives into a profit. And you feel that in these structures. They are an attack on you. And they're telling you exactly what you're worth. And that's why they make me mad. Like that. That's cool. Now, our buildings, they're still altars, but they are altars to very dark gods now. You know, grandiosity and ego and competition and hierarchy and greed are what we were building temples to. And the modern runes and hieroglyphs that we put on our cities are advertisements and warning labels and, you know, cheap sentiments from Hobby Lobby, wall wraps of, you know, friends, faith, family. You know, not anything that is as real as what Wright was trying to hear, you know, kind of cheap sentiment or trends. And we need to remember our higher purpose. You know, the natural world and developing our own soul is why we're here. And we need to trust intuition and innovation and nature again. And when I say that, and not just the nature like leaves on trees, nature like our own human nature that we act like we've transcended, you know, we need to be able to be present in who we are and where we come from. And when I say that Wright is an important person, that's what I mean. That's the best explanation. You know, I wrote this in answer to people that had said, why is it, what do you see in him? That's the best articulation, imperfect articulation of what I hear. And I really wish that our civilization could remember these patterns. And they are still there if you take the time and you take a moment to listen. All right, that was the episode for today. If you have a question or a comment, please send me an email. I'm doing a lot of stuff about design recently. We also did a podcast on chairs, the history of design in chairs, and the Eames chair. And then sometime in July, we're going to sit down with a friend of mine, Will Selman, an urban planner. He's going to share his stories, publishing a book, which is about the fusion of Jungian psychology and urban design, which is a very taproot therapy kind of guest to have. So we're excited for that. Keep checking in. We're not going to do design forever. We've just kind of been on a kick there. But yeah, let me know what you think. Like this topic, a lot of the topics are curated from just questions that I get and try and think about to give you a mindful answer. So if you got one, please send it. I do read those. I am always out of time, but I will get to you as soon as I can. And thank you so much for listening. Have a nice week.